Well, good evening. It's good to be with you this night, even though it is our final night. I hope you're not too tired. wear you out this week. But I do want to thank you for the blessing of being able to be here. Always a blessing to get to know Christians that I haven't known before and meet with brethren that I haven't been able to have a connection with us. That's really special to Teresa and I. It's been nice to be able to both be here, as often doesn't be able to happen. So that's been great. Working with Jim and Roberta and Grandma, and that's been nice. And been enjoyed that time. And I have to say, I mean, there were a few of you. Jim doesn't know this, but there were a few of you that told me that most every preacher commented about Jim's terrible driving, and that wondered whether I would be commenting about it. And I've got to tell you, I mean, we didn't have a problem at all. There was a number of people that got run off into a ditch, but we were okay. Other than that, it was we were doing fine. So we got one more truck to go, and that's at the airport in the morning. So y'all pray, and we'll see how that goes. You know, the most dangerous time is going to the airport, not getting up in the air. That's always something. But no, it's such a pleasure. I'm so excited to be able now to say that I know Jim and Roberta and be able to be have some connection to all of you, and it's been very, very special. And those of you who provided dinners, we greatly appreciate it. It was so nice. Well, you know, the text in Romans tells us that we are saved by hope. Romans 8, 24, 25. We're saved by hope. I don't know how much you ever given thought to that, but I think the main thing that Paul is pointing out there is that is to be our motivation. That is to be the strongest motivation we have. I don't think there's any doubt that most of us, when we first became Christians, we were primarily scared. we didn't want to lose our souls, and we recognized the seriousness of our sins. But as we grow, the Lord does not intend that to be our motivation. Our motivation should grow and evolve into a motivation of love for Him. And that, I think, have always thought that is a huge challenge. And again, maybe primarily because of, and I have to be careful how I say this, but I think you guys understand what I mean. When it goes online, then they'll throw me overboard. But just the idea, if there is an overemphasis of keep the commands, keep the commands, keep the commands, keep the commands, and if you don't keep the commands, you're going to be lost. You will lose God's primary motive in drawing us to love Him. And if you've grown up somewhat that way, as I have, I, number one, appreciate the emphasis on respect God's authority and keep His commands. No doubt about it. But I don't appreciate so much emphasis on that we forgot to get to know God better. And that's what I've wanted to do with you this week, is spend some time so that you see God more clearly. And we've just touched the hem of the garment, obviously. But we're saved in this hope. So when I was growing up, when I thought of heaven, I thought that surely it would be just the best Disneyland ever. I lived 12 miles from Disneyland. Remember when it got started in 1955. Got to visit the very first week that it was going on, 7 years old. And from that time on, Disneyland was, as the advertisement was, the happiest place on earth. It was just so much fun. I thought, heaven has got to be just like Disneyland. It'll just be the best of the best. Well, one thing that I didn't think helped that misunderstanding was when you would talk to Christians about, well, what's heaven like? Well, you got all kinds of weird answers. I mean, I remember a lady I respected a lot. She says, oh, for me, it's just going to be getting to sit on clouds and go around. And I went, I'm not know about that. Sitting on a cloud, really? And there'd be other kinds of things. You go to funerals and somebody'd say, oh man, he's up there in that great big dune buggy in the sky because that's what he liked. Really? And then somebody else say, man, that's Beth is the best golf courses in the world up there in heaven. And you go, huh? And it just everything placed in that kind of thing. And then every once in a while, you go to a singing and I'd hear a song leader say something like, just think, we get to do this throughout eternity. And I went, oh no, I get tired. I didn't appreciate that, even though he had a great statement, but I didn't appreciate it because I didn't understand what that was about. So let's try to get a better understanding of what our hope actually is. So before we start, there's one thing I have to do. I have to lay a foundation, just in case I may be talking to people who understand this completely, and that'd just be wonderful. But a lot of the folks don't. I didn't. Many, many years. And that is how to understand prophecy the way the Jews understood it. So let's use this illustration. You recognize in Matthew chapter 2 when Jesus had to escape as a baby, Joseph and Mary taking him down to Egypt, right? And so he goes down to Egypt and all this in order to escape Herod. And then the scripture says in Matthew 2:15, this was done in order to fulfill the words of the prophet, out of Egypt I've called my son. Right? Okay? And so, you know, we read that and we read over that. And we think, okay, well, there must have been a prophecy back there that said that God would call Jesus out of Egypt. And I'm got to tell you that if you ever check the cross-reference on that, that just isn't so. Now, there is no such prophecy of saying that God would bring Jesus out of Egypt. There isn't a prophecy anywhere in the Bible that talks about that. There's no such thing as that. And the same thing with right after that, when all the babies are killed in Bethlehem, and the scripture says, and this was to fulfill the prophecy, Rachel weeping for her children, for they are not. And you think, well, I guess there must be a prophecy that said that Herod was going to kill a bunch of babies and Rachel was going to weep for her children. Well, there is no such prophecy. It's not found anywhere in the Bible. There's no prophecy about people crying and weeping because the children of Bethlehem were killed. Now, there's texts that say that, but they're not prophecies. In both cases, they're historical statements. In the first case, out of Egypt God called my son, comes from Hosea chapter 11, verse 1, in which God is referring to his son, physical Israel, and how he called him out of Egypt. And he's reminding Israel, I called you out of Egypt as my son. So it says it's a historical statement. The same thing is true in Jeremiah 31:15 when he talks about Rachel weeping for her children. Well, in the context, that's just a historical statement. Rachel, the northern kingdom, was weeping for her children because they'd all been taken away into Assyrian captivity. So Matthew, what are you talking about? How can you so misuse this text to actually say this is a prophecy when it's actually a historical statement? All right, the answer is this. And this is something that we tend to not have understood and therefore missed how much of the Old Testament actually foretells of Jesus. We're looking for little specific statements foretelling something and not realizing that God's history in the Old Testament is foretelling as well. So, the way the Jews would look at it and the way God intended it was that when he said to fulfill the prophecy, out of Egypt I've called my son, he is saying, we're doing a repeat of what happened before. I called my son, physical Israel, out of Egypt to save them. And now I'm bringing a new exodus. And I'm now calling a new people out of Egypt. And here's my leader. Here's my new Moses. Using that historical statement, and we would call it having an echo. The scriptures are doing an echo. God starts something and then he echoes it throughout scripture in order to give you a picture of what our salvation is going to look like. Passing through the Red Sea, as we noticed in the book of Mark the other night, is a baptism that echoes. Going through the Jordan River echoes it. Getting to the New Testament, our baptism, John's baptism, echoes it. God is doing things in the Old Testament in order to give us a picture of how He is going to save us so that we're acquainted with it and so that all the Jews would be able to be easier accepting of what's taking place. It's a much better way to preach baptism, by the way, to our friends, is to show them that it started way back when. And it was no shock to the Jews that they would have to be baptized because that's how they were saved before, out of Egypt. So there's all kinds of things like that. And so just to set you up a little bit, that we're going to look at some things that are going to echo. And our problem is a lot of times is we look at it just as an incident and don't realize that it is going to foretell, a historical event is going to foretell of our salvation later on and what God has planned. Does that make sense? You can say, oh, I have no idea what you're talking about. You go right and say that right now if you want. And I'll answer anything you want. But I hope that makes sense. So let's take them there. And I realize, first time I ever heard that, I had to give some thought to it too. But look at Matthew 2. You'll see a bunch of historical statements that are prophecies. Okay. So go over to Genesis chapter 1, if you will. And I want you to see a pattern here. So, if you're like me, you've read Genesis in which you just read through and you went, okay, hey, cool. God has 6 days of creation. He rests on the seventh day. Then he has a little repeat about creating man. Then he creates the garden and he put man in the garden. And he says, not good to man to be alone. And so he creates Eve and they get married and then they fall into sin. And we have a prophecy and, you know, there's your story. But that's too quick. Everything we need to know about us and what God's intending for us is in Genesis chapter 1 and 2. And so let's see if we can discover that. So we'll begin in chapter 2 and verse 1. And chapter 2, 1 is a statement that is what would be called an inclusio. In other words, it is a bookend. He started with, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And now 2, 1, he kind of repeats that. And everything in the middle was what God had done in creation. So thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God finished his work that he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all his work that he had done. Now, if you take a look at that carefully, you would see a number of differences about the seventh day that you did not see in the first 6 days. So can you think of some of them? Well, what are some of the differences that you would think of that you saw in the first six days you didn't see in the seventh day? Maybe the first one you would think of is, well, there wasn't an evening and a morning. Yeah, there's no evening and morning. There's an evening and morning all 6 days. Evening, morning, 1 day, 2 days, etc., etc. Seventh day, no evening and morning. That's kind of odd. Secondly, what's unique about the seventh day is God blessed it. That's interesting. Before he blessed animals, he blessed man, be fruitful and multiply. How do you bless a day? A blessing for a day indicates there's something special about this day that is going to produce wonderful things. This day is going to be producing something. If man's blessed, the animals are blessed, they're going to produce something. Something good. Well, the seventh day is also being blessed, and so it is going to produce something good, something wonderful. You'll also notice that he actually 4 times in those 2 verses refers to the seventh day. He mentions it specifically 3 times and then says it alludes to it the 4th time. So he says it over and over again. He's really making an emphasis then to the seventh day and how important that seventh day is. And then, of course, most importantly, God rested on that day. He rested on that day. Now that is critically important, because sometimes we think of God resting on that day, and what do we think of? We think, well, I guess God just kind of sat down and pulled up his easy chair and said, all done. No, it isn't that God stopped all activity He rested concerning his creation, but he did not stop all activity, as a matter of fact. You might remember in John chapter 5, around verse 17, Jesus is being ridiculed and is being taken to count because he's healing on the Sabbath day. And Jesus turns around and looks at him and says, "My Father has been working until now, and I have been working." What Jesus is saying is, we didn't stop all work. We didn't stop doing anything. There is the salvation of man. There is spiritual work still to be done. And we are doing that work, and we do that work 7 days a week, including the Sabbath day. In fact, there's no day more important that we would do that work than on the Sabbath day. And so here is a misunderstanding about it. So Jesus then is showing, or God is showing in the Old Testament, and Jesus shows in the New, that all activity has not stopped, but in fact, that this day is an extremely special day. It is a day of rest. All right. Now you're going to see a rest echo all through the Bible. You're going to constantly see a rest echo. When there's a rest echo, what's that pointing to? It's pointing to something great for us. God is preparing us with it, with pictures and symbols and events in which He's showing us the day when that ultimate rest will come. And so He introduces it here. It is wrong to just read over it and pass over it and not really understand the beauty of it. So what do you have then that happens right after this? You will notice this rest that takes place, and then God illustrates the rest by the garden. The garden is a rest scene. Now, we would know that as Christians because we get the end of the Bible too. When you get to Revelation chapter 21 and 22, what do you see? You see a duplicate picture of what you saw back here in the garden. You see a rest. And he even talks about in Revelation, "Blessed are those who die in the Lord, for they will rest from their labors." And so you're seeing this echo that's ending up all the way down here. And so the garden is a rest scene. And I want you to picture what God does just from the Genesis account. So God starts off, you know, and he, after man is made and all this, and he creates the garden. What's the garden look like? Whew. Have you ever stopped and thought about what the garden looked like? I mean, it's just incredible. I mean, if you think Yellowstone, I don't know, well, whatever. I mean, that's junk compared to the garden. He puts every tree that is good for food. He just puts it everywhere. All these wonderful trees. And he takes man and he goes, plop. He goes, check it out. Look at the big river. Man, water, 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 water. You know, look at the big river. Don't eat that tree. So it was always really great. I mean, you can have anything you want. Don't eat that tree. But you have all this. Whatever you want. Eve's made. Bam. You know, Adam wakes up in the morning and says, "Hey, what do you want for breakfast?" I mean, we've got boop, 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 boop. We've got kiwi. We've got this. We've got this. We got everything. What do you want for dinner? What do you want for lunch? What do you want for breakfast? Here we go. I mean, they get a smorgasbord every day. And Adam is told to dress and keep the garden. How does Adam work after he's kicked out of the garden? Ooh. Not so good. Weeds. Love weeds, right? Weeds. Fruit isn't bearing like it did before. Working with the sweat of your brow to get the fruit out of it. You are laboring hard and diligently and tough and you die from it. You return to the ground from it. You serve the ground, he says. But in the garden, you're dressing and keeping. And what's God doing every day in the garden? Well, every day we learn in chapter 3 that God is coming in the cool of the day, walking in the garden to commune with His creation. It's a rest. It's a beautiful picture of God's rest. Now, why would the garden look like a rest? Why is it a picture of rest? Well, because man has the time to to commune with God. I mean, it's like, all the fruit trees are here. I mean, I got a little pruning hook, you know, or pruning shears, and every once in a while I go and go, clip, 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 and I say, hey, honey, 10 o'clock, I've got my work done. Oh, the Lord's coming. Good. We'll have time together. And this whole feel and picture now. What you begin to notice is that God keeps echoing that. So can you think of other things that you see later that look like the garden? That look like the garden rest? How about the land of Canaan? Yeah. Canaan is spoken of as a garden rest. Oh, it's going to be wonderful. He says, you're going to go into Canaan. You don't have to plant any fruit trees. You don't have to build houses. You don't have to do anything. It's all going to be there for you. You just go in and I'm going to whack all those people and you just put your faith in me and they're going to be gone. You're going to walk in and you're just going to take over things that you never had before. As a matter of fact, did you ever notice in Judges chapter 5 that when Joshua gets through the Jordan River, an angel appears with a sword? It's the craziest thing. An angel appears with a sword. And Joshua goes, are you for us or against us? And he says, I'm the angel of the Lord of hosts. Come on in. Last time we saw an angel with a sword when they've been kicked out of the garden. Come on in. You're now given entrance into the garden all over again. And everything is provided again. In fact, in Deuteronomy, God even said in Deuteronomy 11, He says, now look, I want to tell you something. Land of Canaan is going to be totally different than what it was in Egypt. In Egypt, you irrigated your crops and you did all this thing. But when you go to the land of Canaan, it's going to be entirely different because you're going to get in there and you're not going to irrigate your crops because all the rain and water is going to come from me. I'm going to bring the rain. And you serve me and you take care of it. You do what you're supposed to do. And I'm going to give you the rain. And I'm going to give you the fruitful seasons. And I'm going to do all this. Of course, I hope you're thinking ahead and going, huh. So all those times in the book of Judges when suddenly there was famines, Israel should have went, oh, I guess we're not serving the Lord because there's no rain. I mean, this would be a really big duh. There's no rain. See, I'm not serving the Lord. You serve the Lord, you get rain. That's the way it is. He's providing. So this Canaan becomes a time of rest. As a matter of fact, when you read in the book of Joshua, you see in Joshua 21, he brings everybody into the land of Canaan, and it says he fulfilled everything that he had commanded, that he had told he'd give Israel, and he gave them rest from their enemies. What else is a picture of the rest? Well, how about the tabernacle? Oh, yeah. The tabernacle is an echo picture. In fact, even the coverings are embroidered with trees and tree of life and rivers and all this, all picturing it. And here is God dwelling in the midst of it again. But in this case, there is a picture of a barrier all around and nobody can come near. In fact, the Levites camp on either all sides and the priest in the front because the book of Numbers says that you are to camp there lest anyone come near and I kill them. So here's all these Levites camped out around. Don't cross that line. You don't come in here. God dwells in there. He'll kill you. He'll kill you if you come in. But He's showing us that there is a desire for God to dwell in the midst and there is a picture of a coming rest. What's another thing that would picture a rest? Most obvious of all, happens every week for Israel. Sabbath, right? Sabbath, every Sabbath. Now check it out. We think of that and we just go, okay, yeah, Sabbath. No. Up until the Sabbath, what were they? They were slaves in Egypt. How many days did they work? 24/7. They are working every day. So what God says is, okay, I delivered you. I'm your new master. I now own you. And here's the deal. I'm commanding you not to work. One day a week, I want you to rest. Can you imagine going to your work and the boss looks at you and says, what are you doing here? You say, well, you know, I thought I'd come and, you know, do some extra work. And he looks at you and says, if I ever catch you down here again, I'm going to whack you. You go home and rest. And I better not find out that when you got home, you're out there working in the yard. I better find out when you got home that you're enjoying your family and your children and your God. Now get out of here. And by the way, I'm paying you. You go, man, I like this guy. It's pretty good. That's what God's doing. Is that the only rest He gave him? What about every seventh year? What? Every seventh year, God says, okay, check it out. You're taking the whole year off. You're not going to work. You go, wait a minute, how am I going to eat? Because I am going to bless you like you cannot believe, and the sixth year is going to last you all the way to the harvest the eighth year. Now don't work. Well, what am I going to be doing? You and I are going to have time together. You're not going to have to work. You're going to enjoy me and enjoy the blessings I have. What about the year of Jubilee? 50th year. What comes before the 50th year? 49th year. What's in the 49th year? Well, the 49th year is the sabbatical year. It's the every 7 year year. And the 50th year, what do you mean? Wait a minute. You're giving us 2 years off? I'm giving you 2 years off in the 50th year. And you say, how am I going to eat? Because I'm going to give you so much stuff. You're going to eat all the way until the harvest the 51st year. Now I want you to enjoy. Rest. Man, I tell you what. That sounds really sweet. And do you know what Israel did? They went to work anyway. Why did God get so angry with them? Why, when you read Ezekiel and so many of the prophets, He talks about their immoralities, but He never fails to say, and you broke my Sabbaths. Why? Because God said, you're not appreciating the fact that I am blessing you so that you and I can have time together. We can commune together. I'm dwelling in your midst. This is a time to love and enjoy and take care of one another. This is a time to stop and be quiet, for I am your God. And they wouldn't listen. It was the worst of the worst. So you see all these pictures over and again of rest. So think for a moment. What does that have to do, and how is it that that is fulfilled in us? What does that look like for us? Let's take a look over in Genesis chapter 22. And I want you to notice a promise given to Abraham. We alluded to this briefly in a previous lesson. But it's in Genesis 22, and this is right after Abraham offers Isaac. And in verse 15 of Genesis 22, the Scripture says, "And the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven, and said, By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this, and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you." Now, by the way, when you see the word bless, you should think the opposite is curse. God had curses from sinning in the garden, and now God comes around, He's reversing curses, and He's bringing blessings. So there was curses on the land, and there was curses on the offspring, and there was curses as far as dying because you've sinned, and now God is blessing, and He's reversing each of those curses. So that's the picture. All right, and then He says, in verse 17 again, "I will surely bless you. I will surely multiply your offspring as the stars of the heaven, as the sand that is on the seashore, and your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies." Now those two right there, as we mentioned before, the first is the great nation promise. I will multiply your offspring. The second is the land promise. I will not only multiply your offspring, but I will also, your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies. Now, what does that mean? This is a fuller definition of what it means for a land promise. We have in our idea, in our heads a lot of times, which is a mistaken idea, that the land promise is a piece of dirt with some borders on it. And it is not. A piece of dirt with its borders on it doesn't do you any good if all the enemies get to come in and whack you. Right? That's not a rest. That's not what God promised. And so he says here, your offspring will possess the gate of his enemies. In other words, who's taking care of whose gate? But in physical Israel's history, who was at whose gate? The enemies were at Israel's gate. But God says the day would come when you'll possess the gate of your enemies. You'll tell them when they can come out and come in. You will overpower. That's the essence then of the land promise. It is a security. It is a peace. It is a position in which no one can take away what we have. And Israel never had that. Yes, they got a piece of dirt. Briefly. And it was taken away from them. But I'm going to give you a little hint here. We're going to look at it. Israel was not the ultimate fulfillment of the land promise. Canaan was not the ultimate fulfillment of the land promise. That was an echo that is going to be echoed even greater. See it in just one second. The third promise here, of course, in verse 18, where he says, "And in your offspring all nations of the earth be blessed," and we have talked about that. But we want to talk about this rest. So when you see those that in verse 17, now hold on to that. Let's take those words and let's go over to Isaiah 54. I want you to see how Isaiah repeats this and speaks of it as in the days of the Messiah. Isaiah chapter 54. Now, the first thing I need to emphasize to you is this is a very, very important point. I know this is going to be very deep, very difficult. But Isaiah 54 comes after Isaiah 53. So, just make sure you get that. That's really important. Why? Because Isaiah 53 is about what? The suffering servant. The sacrifice of Jesus for our sins. And the outcome of his sacrifice is in chapter 54. Now you know why that's important. Okay? 54 verse 1. "Sing, O barren one who did not bear. Break forth into singing and cry aloud, you who did not have not been in labor. For the children of the desolate one will be more than the children of her who is married, says the Lord." Who's the barren one? Say it, somebody. Sarah. Sarah is the barren one. You can rejoice. Break forth in singing. You have not been in labor. For the children of the desolate. Who's the desolate? Sarah. Sarah is desolate. You will have more children than the one who's married. Whoops. Who's the one married? Hagar. Now you know why Sarah got so mad at Hagar. You remember when Hagar conceived? What'd she do? She went strutting into Sarah and went, "I'm the true wife around here. You're nobody." Typical ancient day. "You're nobody. I'm the true wife around here." And what? You imagine all those 14 years before Sarah gave birth to Isaac? How? You imagine those 14 years for Sarah? They had to be utter agony. That woman every day getting up and going, "Ha, ha, ha. I'm the true wife around here." No wonder Sarah dealt harshly with her. Now what's the prophet say? The children of the desolate, the barren one, you rejoice now, for you will have more children than the one who was married, counted herself as married. So, how does Sarah have more children? Physical Israel? No. Spiritual Israel. How do I know? Because that passage is quoted by Paul in Galatians chapter 4, and he says it is. Remember the allegory in Galatians 4? Hagar represents the physical nation, and Sarah represents the spiritual nation, Christians, the people of God, the heavenly Jerusalem. Who has more children? We do. Sarah does. The Messiah's offspring. Chapter 53 and down in around verse 11 or so. The offspring is greater. Now who has the great nation promise? Israel or us? Us. We are the great nation promise. Israel is not the great nation promise. They were an echo of what we would be. We are the great nation. What do we think the kingdom of Christ is? What do we think the kingdom of God is? What do we think was announced in Mark 1? about the coming of the kingdom. This is it. This is the great nation God has always promised that would be His own possession. 1 Peter chapter 2, we've talked about that. There would be a holy nation who would be His own people, who would be this great priesthood. Who is this? This is us. He wasn't talking about the physical nation. That was simply an immediate physical fulfillment that was echoing as a prophetic statement for who we are. Ah, oh, but look on in Isaiah 54. Look at verse 2. Enlarge the place of your tent, and let the curtains of your habitations be stretched out. Do not hold back. Lengthen your cords and strengthen your stakes. For you will spread abroad to the right and the left, and your offspring shall possess the nations and will be people the desolate cities. What's the borders of the land promise now? The whole world. Do you see the possess the nations? That's just what He promised Abraham. Your offspring will possess the gates of your enemy. And here in Isaiah, He says, here it is. Stretch out. Your little land isn't big enough. Stretch it out. Pull it out. Enlarge your tent. Your offspring now is going to possess all the nations of the world. You're going to bring the Gentiles in. Why in the parable of the tares? When Jesus gives the interpretation, the parable of tares in Matthew chapter 13, verse 37, He says, the field is the world. Whoa. What's the kingdom? It's the world. Where does Jesus reign? The whole world. What's the realm of the kingdom? The whole world. What's the land promise? Not the physical Palestine. That was an echo. That was a prophetic echo of something much greater that we are now beginning to experience, but have not completely experienced until our heavenly realm, in which we now possess it all. See the pictures? God is just bringing us along, showing us step by step what's really happening here. Now, go over to, we're going to look at two New Testament passages. Go over to Hebrews chapter 4. And this will bring all of this together for us. Hebrews chapter 4. So, just to get you context, I wish we could read all of chapter 3 and 4, and this would be great. Okay, we'll stay in the route. No, I don't want to do that. So here, I got an early flight. Can't do that. But here we are. So Hebrews 4, He is going to talk about, notice just the first words of Hebrews 4. Therefore, while the promise of entering His rest still stands. Why is the promise of entering His rest, notice His rest, why is the promise of entering His rest still stand? Because right before that, He quoted from Psalm 95. Who wrote Psalm 95? King David. And King David was warning his people that if they became rebellious like the people of the days of the wilderness, they would not enter His rest. So since David still spoke of a rest 500 years after they came out of Egypt, the argument of the Hebrew writer is the rest never ended. Does that make sense? Yes. Why? Because there's no evening and morning in the seventh day. The seventh day never ended. It just kept right on going. Think it didn't? Let's read Hebrews 4. He says it did. Hebrews 4, now going on to verse 1 again. Therefore, while the promise of entering His rest still stands, let us fear lest any of you should seem to have failed to reach it. For good news came to us just as to them, but the message they heard did not benefit them because they were not united by faith with those who listened. For we who have believed enter that rest. Now here's first century. People still entering the rest who believe. We who believe have entered that rest, as He said, as I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. So He's saying, look, God says, I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. And that was repeated by David 1000 B.C., long after Canaan, and therefore the rest is still there. So we still have an opportunity to enter. And He says, and He goes on at the end of verse 3, although His works were finished from the foundation of the world, for He has somewhere spoken of the seventh day in this way. And God rested on the seventh day from all His works. And again in the passage, he said, they shall not enter my rest. Since therefore it remains for some to enter it, and those who formerly received the good news failed to enter because of disobedience, again he appoints a certain day. Okay, stop. So what did he just say? He said what we concluded when we were back reading Genesis. That when there was no evening and morning of the seventh day, what that meant is the seventh day never came to an end. And the seventh day rest has been going on, and God blessed that seventh day because he wants to bring everybody into his rest. And so here the Hebrew writer is able to say, remember when he said that back in Genesis 2? He said it because that rest is still available for them, for us, for everyone, as long as the world stands, to actually enter the rest. How cool! And then he goes on to say, verse 7, again he appoints a certain day, today, saying through David so long afterward. David spoke 500 years after the Canaan, entrance into Canaan, 400 years, whatever, after the entrance of Canaan. So long afterward, David was still talking about a rest. That's all he's saying there. So he appoints that certain day, saying so long afterward, in the words they quoted, today if you'll hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. Now watch this, verse 8. For if Joshua had given them rest, God would not have spoken of another day later on. So then there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. Everybody catch that? Next time somebody asks you a question, did God give Israel rest in the land of Canaan? You can very easily say, no. He did not. And there wasn't a Jew in the face of the earth thought he did. Not a Jew in the first century, not a Jew all the way through there. Because why? Because they didn't possess the gate of their enemies. One little blip of time when David and Solomon were king, they had that control, but it was gone because they did not obey the Lord. And besides, even though Joshua 21 says he gave them and fulfilled everything he said, that was still just an echo of something greater, because the Hebrew writer plainly says here, Joshua did not give them rest. I mean, how much plainer can you say it? Joshua did not give them rest. So we're mistaken when we teach our kids in our Sunday school, and when we were taught in our Sunday school, well, there's three promises. There's the great nation promise, there's the land promise, and the offspring promise. We get the offspring promise, those Jews got the other. Wrong! We get all three promises. We are the ones who possess the gate of our enemies now. We have been raised up to be seated with Him in Christ in the heavenly places. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 6 and 7. We are sitting on His throne with Him. We are reigning with Him. No, we possess the gate of our enemy. This is, see, I'll tell you what the great application of this is. We need to stop wimping out. I wimp out, you wimp out. We need to stop wimping out and acting like this world around us is in the majority. They're not in the majority. We're in the majority. They got more people. We got a bigger God. We reign. And we are in a kingdom that cannot be conquered and can be taken away. And they are the ones that we possess. We possess the gate of their enemies, our enemies. They do not possess us. We can stand strong. Ooh, we're going to need that. You can see what's happened in our country. We're going to need that. And this is very, very important to see these great principles. Now, one other thing. Look at chapter 6 of Hebrews. Chapter 6 of Hebrews, verse 13. He is trying to assure and bring these Hebrew Christians to no longer be sluggish. What's going to keep you from being sluggish? Having an assurance of what God's promised to give you. Verse 13. For when God made a promise to Abraham, since he had no one greater by whom to swear, he swore by himself, saying, surely I will bless you and multiply you. Where does that quote come from? What we just read in Genesis 22, 16, and 17. And what was that quote he was swearing he would do? Multiply your offspring and have you possess the gate of your enemies, and in your offspring all nations be blessed. That's what he swore. And who's he talking about in Hebrews 6? Us. Us. Not the physical nation. Us. Look at the great promise. And thus Abraham, verse 15, having patiently waited, obtained the promise, but for people swear by something greater than themselves, and in all their disputes an oath is final for confirmation. So when God desired to show more convincingly, what's God desiring to do by making an oath by Himself? He desired to show more convincingly to the heirs of promise. Who's that? Us. To the heirs of promise, the unchangeable character of His purpose. He guaranteed it with oath. You see, one of the things we often miss, when God made those three promises back in Genesis 22, when God made those three promises, it was a unilateral promise. He was going to do it regardless of how many people sinned and how much sin there was. He's going to do it anyway. This whole world couldn't have sinned enough for God to break those three promises. I'm going to do it. Oh, you can either submit to it or not submit to it, and that's going to be your choice, but I'm going to do it. And He swore by Himself, and He says, I want to give you convincing. I want to convince you beyond any shadow of a doubt. And I have an unchangeable character of my purpose. He guaranteed it with an oath. Verse 18, so that by two unchangeable things, that is, He promised and He swore, in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have fled for refuge, who's that? That's us too. We who have fled for refuge might have strong encouragement to hold fast to the hope set before us. We have this as a sure and steadfast anchor of the soul, a hope that enters into the inner place behind the curtain where Jesus has gone as a forerunner on our behalf, having become a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Put that together. Here's what God says. He says, look, I know one thing. I know my heirs. I know my people to come. They are going to struggle with whether or not I'm going to keep my promise and save them. And they're going to start getting sluggish and they're going to want to give up. And they're just going to struggle with it. I know they are. And so what I need to do is I'm going to give them strong encouragement to hold fast. You know how I'm going to give them this strong encouragement? I'm not just going to make a promise. I'm going to swear. I'm going to swear by me. God says, I couldn't swear by anybody. He says, I just swear by me. And He says, I can't lie. And I can't break the promise. And I want to swear by me so that I have give you strong encouragement to hold fast that hope that's set before you. And this is an anchor. Whereas you go with fishing, my grandpa, he'd throw out an anchor, and sometimes we'd be fishing, all of a sudden a branch would hit us in the head because the anchor wasn't holding. You got an anchor. Where's that anchor go? It goes right into the most holy place of heaven, where Jesus is holding on to it as a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. And all of chapter 7 is saying this one thing, and you see it in verse 25 and 26. All of chapter 7 is saying this one thing. You've got a high priest. He's in the most holy place of heaven, the true holy place and the true tent. He's brought His own blood in there. And that anchor is right in there. And every day, He's interceding for you. Remember when you couldn't get into the temple? Remember when it was guarded all the way around and nobody could enter? Now you enter. Boldly you enter, chapter 10 and verse 19. And He is there holding on. You have that anchor. And you never, ever, ever, ever say, He wouldn't want me. I've sinned and He wouldn't want me now. And you never, ever give up. And you never, ever think you should, because I'm just not good enough. That's right, you're not. Who said you were? He's in there, your great high priest. That's why we need a high priest. We need Him in there. And He's taken His blood in there. And He is forever in there, saving us to the uttermost. And the anchor goes right into that veil. And you hold on to it. That's the picture. There's only one other thing in Genesis chapter 2. Marriage. Marriage. And we go, oh, how nice. Adam, let me introduce you to Eve. Eve, let me introduce you to Adam. Kissing. I pronounce you husband and wife. You know, God goes, okay, there we are. And we go, oh, sweet, go to chapter 3. No. Because Adam says, what? He says, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She should be called woman because she's taken out of man. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two should become one flesh. And Paul quotes it in Ephesians 5, as we read the other night. And what's Paul say? Wasn't talking about marriage. Echo. Echo. What's God doing? He's foretelling in our earthly marriages foretelling what His intention is, always has been for us. No wonder Jesus in John 6, when the Jews murmured about Him saying, "I'm the bread of life," He said the most amazing words. Did you ever hear it? He said, "No one comes to Me unless the Father who sent Me draws him." That word "draw" has the idea of a man drawing and wooing a woman to Himself. All of the Bible has been God wooing us and drawing us to Him. All of it. Everything. You'll always notice God acts first and then says, "See how much I love you. See what I..." And He's drawing us. We love Him because He first loved us. 1 John 4:19. What is Jesus saying? Have you come to the Father? Have you come to Jesus? He says, you don't come to Jesus unless the Father woos you, draws you. So let's see if we can't get this down. You know how I got Teresa to marry me? I was carrying around a whole list of commandments for the wife I wanted. And when I met her, I pulled out, I said, "That's the babe." And I pulled it out and I went, "You know, here's all the commandments. You want to marry me?" She went, "Oh my goodness, I've fallen in love." Try it. No, don't. You see how our approach has been? This is where we mess up. When we're trying to teach our kids, when we're trying to teach people on the outside, we come and bombard them with a pile of commandments before they even know the love of God. Oh, they know Jesus died for the sins, but they don't understand the love. They don't understand the story. They don't understand the beautiful picture. They don't understand how God is drawing them. We start with love. Remember what Jesus said? "If you love Me, you will keep My commandments." I don't walk into the house every day and think, "You know, if I really trash this place, I don't really think she'll divorce me, so I think I'll trash it." No. I walk in and go, "What could I do? What could I do that would really make her smile?" That's what I do. Because I love her. That's what we do with God. What can I do that I know He's revealed to me that would really please Him because I love Him? And we draw near to Him and we desire Him and we want Him. And you say right now, you may not be there, and that's okay. No one is all the time. You may not be there. Love is a growth process. But you have to get into the Word to make that love happen. Because John 6:45 says, the way He draws us is they shall all be taught of God. So guess what? It isn't Disneyland. And some people are probably disappointed with that. But the people who are disappointed because they have not tasted the love of God. What a hope. What a God. I cannot wrap my mind around what He's promised all of us. Let's live that life. Wow. Makes you want to do more than you've ever done. Thank you for our time together. We're going to sing a song. If we can help anyone in any way in your walk to God, please step forward while together. Please stand while we sing.